when you brought up the question of the speaking from the perspective of Christ and entering the perspective of Christ, this reminded me of a book on George Herbert that I read recently that was all about how poetry tunes the soul, and or how the struggling speaker in those poems deals with the problem of relating to God and the problem of always being, never being able to make a complete sacrifice and trying to take on the position of Christ and make a complete sacrifice and then being just like insufficient over and over again. But that process is actually from of trying to enter into Christ's passion and faith. An actual, that sort of dynamic process is part of what repentance and tuning the soul would have been.
The other thing I would add to that is that in the New World, there were plenty of plays where indigenous people would play the Holy Family and so on, and that was considered to be a very useful means of sort of tuning them in with the kind of feelings that Christianity was trying to passion, whatever that Christianity was trying to promote. So by performing as Mary,
so
Jesus, and so on, they were in fact converted.
Similarly
with music.
Yeah.
An interesting addendum to that is that you're never pretending to be Jesus alone. You know, if your friend is pretending to be Jesus, and then you're watching your friend pretending to suffer, then this elicits a response too, right? And this is, it's a five-part piece. So it's not one person pretending to be Jesus, it's five people.
Or
six people, the other choice. Or 12 people if you're two to a part. You know, so it's also, it's not as egotistical, it's not as individualistic as it may seem just by reading the text alone, is what I'm trying to say.
True. What I wanted to say is that this piece is not that orthodox. Okay, there are many ways in which you can communicate religion and faith and belief, but I'm referring to a specific kind of orthodoxy that was in place during the 16th century, especially the Vatican. And that specific one, aside from the Neoplatonic influences, were very much influenced by the Middle Age interpretation of Aristotle, which said that poets are not actors, and actors should be banished. Whoever speaks in another person's name, acting like somebody else, is a yoculator. Therefore, he has to be banished, and he's not considered a poet. So what I'm asking you is that, is this the reason why it was so interesting for the new church that was building up during those years, the Protestant church, to incorporate this chant, this song into their own chants or not? Was this the most important thing that decided whether or not to use it as a liturgical hymn or not?
Well, this piece wasn't used in the Lutheran service. It's just reproduced in Protestant prints.
Okay.
Those particular prints were produced for...
They weren't singing them.
They were produced for...
Yeah, they were...
For home use.
Right.
Primarily from home use.
And possibly school.
And school
still,
use.
That means that they accepted it as something that wasn't going
against
their...
It wasn't against Lutheran theology, but it also didn't...
Even though they speak about Olympus, celestial Olympus.
Well, there's lots of humanist Lutherans, too. I mean, but go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know whether your vision of early 16th century Vatican was... The intellectual environment in Italy and Spain at that moment is changing quite a lot. No? There are reforms, and also the whole discussion about new narrative devices No, the issue that you mentioned as this I, no, you have the birth of the modern novel at this time, and new ways of narrating things that you, perhaps you can make a connection between those these new ways of experimenting with self, not just how you write, no, and how it, this me or this I appears in the music. No? I don't know. On the other hand, the connection, there's a strong connection between this love poetry of the 15th century and the new mystical poetry of the 16th century that poets such as St. John of the Cross and Teresa de Ávila and many others in this area are going to experiment with, in which sexual references are constant, no? In order to approach this attempt to blend with divinity, and so.
Is it new to the Renaissance? I don't think that
the
erotic mysticism is new to the Renaissance.
I mean, it's already in the Bible, in the Psalms.
Yeah.
But the thing is,
yes.
how in the Renaissance this gets mixed, no, between the tradition of courtly love. No, and the mystical and the mystical traditions, and how each one reinforces each other.
Yeah. It has a huge expansion.
Which has a strong influence in the Vatican. It's not that it's the important Charles V.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying also is it's not just the erotic within the religious. It's also this. You said new ways of experiencing the self, to extend your metaphor, to think of this as a kind of a growth of ideas of self-tuning, and that's through music, through poetry, through theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, on one hand, we have the idea of self-tuning, in which you're sort of putting yourself in order, and I think that's a very powerful image for music, but the other one is actually stirring you up. Okay, so that's more the idea of the passions. And I, you know, I do think that 16th century music does more of that, of actually having more extreme contrast, using more chromaticism, using more dissonance, using more affective texts. Now, actually, for motets, interestingly, this period around sort of 1480 to 1520, there's a lot of interesting texts for motets, prayer texts and interesting sort of Neo-Latin poetry and all kinds of stuff. And then later 16th century motets, which is this genre of sacred music that is often part of the liturgy, not necessarily, tends to be more traditional liturgical texts. They move away from the prayer texts and so forth, and more to much more standard liturgical items, responsories and antiphons, things like this. But nevertheless, they're still going for these more affective musical devices, things that even modern listeners can recognize as like they're out to get you. They're out to push your buttons in a way. I mean, I don't know. I think there is a change, and I think it's partly about persuasion. That's sort of what I said in my blog post, is that now there's competition. You have to persuade people. Yeah.
I've just looked up on the King James Bible,
yeah,
the word stir.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely domestic version of conversion. It's a very, very powerful word in the Old and New Testament.
Neat. Yeah. Yeah.
Also the stir of Sunday, the collect. Before Lent begins, or Advent, stir up our hearts, O Lord.
Right, yeah, Melanie.
How important is performance to activating the effective content? I mean, if people are using these in domestic situations and singing them like one would read a devotional text, does that, I mean, for the listener taking on Christ's voice, or I guess the performer, is there a difference between performing and listening?
You mean performing for an audience or listening?
Yeah.
Or you mean being an audience member who's not singing and
yes,
somebody who is singing?
Correct.
What's the difference? That's a really good question. Anna, go ahead.
I just have a question that, to add to that, the inquest of the period ear got me thinking about, which is, how are you supposed to know, and are you never allowed to use contemporary experience to teach you what it is to sing inside of, to be a listener inside of a piece of litany while you're singing? Is that what this...
Oh, no, I don't think he's saying that. I think he's saying more like... no, he's not shutting off anything, I think. At least that's the way I read it. I don't know what other people think.
And, I mean, again, related to that, so we've had former and audience.
Yeah.
But the author is crucial as well, because he's someone who's, I mean, instead of, you're saying, delegating his work to others, his autoritas, literally his authorship, to be reproduced, hopefully faithfully, by other people. So, you know, what's in it for some eccentric lone composer like Carlo Gesualdo, for example, who's not part of it?
Well, actually, I mean, there's no such thing as an eccentric lone composer.
Right. Okay.
Because you always have to be interacting with musicians.
Right.
And pretty much every composer in the Renaissance is a singer. And Gesualdo was also a count or whatever he was, but he also sang and performed. There are accounts of him playing the lute and performing his own music at these different courts in northern Italy. So, I mean, music is essentially social.
And it wasn't considered a sort of rough workman sort of thing? Like, you know,
no, he was criticized for being too good at music, and that's not being appropriately noble.
Right.
So, no. So, I mean, actually, it is... And actually, I don't think the composer is really that important. It's sort of important, but the music... Most of the sources for this piece are after Josquin was dead. Yes, they were admiring him, but he was like a mythical figure. It's not like he still had control over them. Yeah.
I've done work on the Renaissance eye and the image, and the there's a strong idea in the period that there's something quasi-physical that enters the eye and can affect in a kind of physical imprinting way. And I always, I mean, I've done a little bit of reading on hearing, but are there competing theories? What are the stronger theories? But what happens when it goes in? Where does it go? What does it do?
Well, Ficino writes about this in the 16th century.
Well, it's 15.
No.
15th century. Yeah. Sorry. yes. I think he died in 1499. And he writes that the hearing can affect the spirit more than any other sense, because the spirit is made of air, and sound is transmitted over air. And sound, unlike something that you see, sound is actually motion, and it actually moves the air in your spirit. That's how I understand it correctly. And so that would be the equivalent.
What's the text?
I wrote it...
Letters.
Yeah, I posted on the blog as well.
Okay.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, I think we need to make all our blogs open to everybody.
Oh,
that's something we can talk about. Because only the Sense of Hearing blog is only for Sense of Hearing people now, and vice versa. But this is something we need to discuss with the management committee, because I think we'd all like to read with each other, because there's always going to be all these overlaps. But yeah.
David missed the introductions, but he's our web person.
Well, we can't decide. That was just my opinion. I mean, other people might disagree, so I guess we have to have some kind of consultation about that.
We can poll the groups.
But it would be fun to poll, because I think we really get a lot out of reading each other's posts and each other's stuff.
I'm preparing for a reading group.
Yeah, exactly, Well, all this stuff was, everyone had access to, all of my stuff.
Nobody, the blogs.
The blogs, exactly, exactly. But yes, go ahead.
Do we have a history of the performances of this piece in the 16th century? Where and when?
No.
No, that's... I mean, we don't have very much evidence of that kind of thing. What we have is sources. So you can make... Like, the fact that this is in the Sistine Chapel, of course, means it was sung in the Sistine Chapel. But for a lot of sources, we don't know where it came from. We know it's now in this library, in this city, but we don't know what church it was sung, who owned it, and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And I think Sistine Chapel sources could also have been performed outside of the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah, elsewhere in Rome. Yeah.
So, I mean, this might not have been a piece that was sung in church. It might have been a before-dinner piece.
That's right. We know that they sang motets while the Pope was sitting at dinner and so forth, and so lots of other contexts. Yeah, Marco.
Professor Strand's questions. Do we know perhaps when was the motet used during the liturgical calendar?
Wait, what was that again?
When was the motet
used
during the liturgical calendar?
No, we don't know that. And in fact, in general, motets, the genre of motet, had a lot of flexibility, so they could be in multiple different places. So they didn't have one assignment. Even a motet that was a setting of a responsory from a certain feast could have been performed at some other feast, or not in church at all. So the whole thing about the motet is that it's very flexible. I wrote a book about that. So. yeah, so we're just about out of time. Does anyone have any sort of final comments? Or this is really very, very useful, this discussion, thank you. But anybody have any final... Yeah, Anna.
I just have a... We sort of came up with this self-tuning idea, but I would be very cautious about that as a anachronism, because this poem that we just read is all about the relationship between God as active, who pierces Christ. He pierces himself first, but then he pierces your heart through the poem and through his sacrifice. And then at the very end, again, the question is, what can I give back? And he says, then you can give back love. But the whole question is all about amor is the subject of these sentences over and over again. It takes the most emphatic position at line end, and the first at the end of the first sentence, and then at the end of the poem altogether. And so it's God that's active, and the soul and the listener is not active. It's in the passive, and only after being penetrated can it have the
no, but I mean, the idea is that
then I return love.
You put yourself in the position by listening or singing the motet to be acted upon.
Yes.
But by doing that, then you are, in fact, participating in your own salvation.
Yes.
So
yes, that makes sense.
So.
Yeah. No, you're right to caution us about not imagining church as going to or watching Oprah.
It's not a self-help book. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I mean, it's also important to remember that prayers also had this thing about actually, if you're praying for your dead relatives, it's actually giving them less time in purgatory. The act of singing was also an act about helping someone else's soul in the Catholic, not the Lutheran tradition. But that's also a very important part of this. You're actually, you know, you're saving someone possibly from eternal damnation by singing this. So. You shouldn't forget that, yeah.
Well, I just want to go back to Melanie's question about how the performance changes the meaning of the piece, whether it's domestic or in the church or at the Duke's meal. And to me it seems like it's also a question of what's the function of it and what's the job of the people singing it. I mean, if you're singing this piece at home, then you don't get fined for singing a wrong note. But if you're singing it in the Sistine Chapel... that if you sing a wrong note, you have to pay a fine, right? I mean, or
I know, but in some
churches, institutions,
sure
you definitely had to pay
example,
a fine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it changes, in my experience as a musician who plays and sings for money, it kind of changes how much you can really get into the piece. I mean, I was singing in church yesterday with very little rehearsal, and I was in arcade mode half the time.
You know?
No, arcade mode is where, you know, you pass this section and then you level up and you pass the next section and, you know, if you get to the end without falling off, you're basically just, you know.
That's a question of repertoire and your own experience as someone who's coming into, like, a choral program that you weren't already part of. The people who would have been singing this in a church, would they not have known this motet and sang it every year?
Oh, not necessarily, no.
No, you could. I mean, not the first time. Yeah. Not the first time around, when it was new.
That's right.
Then they wouldn't have necessarily had a lot of rehearsal.
No, I don't think they had any more. I think they had less rehearsal then than we do now. I mean, it's true you were singing with a group that you sang with for 30 years, so you got very, very good at singing together, but I think a lot of it must have been routine, just the way. But, I mean, the thing is, we can imagine... I mean, I think maybe our final thing is that there are multiple listeners, there are multiple performers, there are multiple ways of experiencing it, which emphasize one or the other. And so, in some sense, the idea of the period ear is ridiculous, because there's multiple ears now, and there were multiple ears then. On the other hand, thinking about what it meant to listen or what the experience was is very interesting, and it allows you to think about what, I mean, it's a kind of, your soul is converted if you're really paying attention and you're taken up into this piece. And so I think that's a good ending, eh?
Thank you.
Thank you. That was great.